Have you ever been lost out on the internet or found something really cool? It was nothing you needed or wanted, but you found it anyway. Author Richard Thieme says the net is a swirl of invisible currents. We learn to surf swells of meaning that surge back and forth like the sea. He writes, we become voyagers in the sea of information in which we are immersed, plunging through high seas in outrigger canoes. We make our own tangled star maps that represent and remember for us how to find our way back home. Well, maybe you'll find your way home, but sometimes not. Thieme adds, the internet is a geodesic in which infinite strands of crosstalk shrink the world to the size of a space station. But wait, isn't the need for individuality getting lost in the sea of engineering infrastructure? What about our moral center? And what's all this doing to our young people who have maybe too much time on their hands? Thinking inside and outside the box this hour on the West Side. I'm Mary Jo Wagner. Richard Thieme taught English literature, spent 16 years as a priest in the Episcopal Church. After finding that was suffocating, he left and started a new phase in his life as a speaker, commentator, and an author. A society of professional engineers asked him to write a monthly column about the internet. His columns are part of a book, Islands in the Clickstream. He's in Eau Claire to make a presentation at the university tomorrow, and he's with us this afternoon. Welcome to you.
Hi, Mary Jo. Good to be here.
And just in case I get lost in this discussion, Professor Thomas Hilton is here, and he chairs the Management Information Systems Department at UW-Eau Claire. Welcome to you.
Hi, Mary Jo.
Am I going to get lost?
I hope not. I rather doubt it. I listened to some of Richard's work earlier, and he seems quite approachable to me.
Ah, so Richard Thieme, you say I'm a right-brain guy in a left-brain world.
It's true.
Images and visions are more real to me than abstractions. I see the future more easily than things that are right in front of my face. A visionary who's an expert on technology, how did that happen?
Well, it started with my son. One of the points I like to make when people ask me, how can I get into this? Because it's a daunting and sometimes frightening domain, and I'm not familiar with computers. We have to partner with new kinds of people, and often with our children. I bought my son an Apple II Plus computer when he was 12 years old, and I was frightened to use it because I didn't know how to use it. I didn't know what it was good for. And I stood behind him. He opened the box. He read the manual. He started programming. He's never taken a course. He makes his living. Started a company in Silicon Valley, and it actually made a profit, and it's doing very, very well. They make smart panels, and he's self-taught. And I realized that if I was very respectful, kind, and just diligent in the way I came to him, he would teach me what I needed to know. So a lot of people are finding, including educators, that they have to partner with their students because the students have been socialized or changed by their ready access to the new technology. It's like a language. And kids learn languages more easily, and then our brains change, and we don't.
Do you remember when you first sat in front of a computer?
I do. I absolutely do. It was at Apple II. And there was a little green stick figure who danced to music that chimed, and we laughed in delight like children, clapping our hands. We couldn't believe what the computer could do. Yeah. But the real moment for me of transformation was when we started playing interactive fiction games like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and Trinity and A Mind Forever Voyaging. These are, I think, classic literary works that began to be developed by Infocom. And because I had taught lit, I had some clue about how text works. And in the ministry, what you really do is unpack text on behalf of creating community.
Oh, go back now. As a minister, you unpack.
Well, the ministry in most religions or denominations starts with a written work, a written scripture text, and your job is to interpret the text for a community. And you do that not just once a week, but you do it when you teach, you do it when you counsel, you do it when you preach, you do it to large groups, small groups, individuals. You're always coming from the point of reference that the text instructs you to have when you're trying to build a community along religious values based on shared symbols and narratives and structures. It was just a natural when I was playing this interactive fiction game on the computer to suddenly notice that I was being changed by the process in a different way than when I read a book. And I had this epiphany, really, that if I was genuinely being reprogrammed or restructured or altered in the way that I perceived, and the society was going to be affected in the same way by network computers once that ramped up, because this was very early on, 93, 4, something like that.
This is while you were Episcopal priest?
You've still got an Episcopal
epiphany.
Priest.
You were right then.
I had this epiphany that if what's happening to me is what I perceive, then this is going to happen to society. And this really is the latest instantiation of a long era, 200 years of electronic communication transforming society, beginning with the telegraph.
And it is transforming.
It is.
It's very transforming.
I have a section in my book called Nearly Perfect Predictions or something, because now I have a track
record. Mostly perfect.
Thank you. I'm glad you read it, and I just wrote it. I was pretty much right, pretty much most of the time. And I wrote a long essay called Computer Applications for Spirituality, The Transformation of Religious Experience. And let me just explain what happened, because it's illustrative of why I left. I sent it to the Anglican Theological Review, and I got it back with comments in the margin that were just hostile, beyond hostile.
You were thinking outside the box.
Who does he think he is?
Yeah,
God forbid was my favorite exclamation point. I hope not, and things like that.
And how long ago was that?
That was in the early 90s.
Yeah.
Early 90s.
And you were already hooked into a computer on a daily basis at that time.
Late well, 80s, maybe.
And let me get Professor Hilton in there.
Okay.
You've read the book. You read his book, right?
I have read pieces of his book. I wish I had read it all. It's very interesting.
What was your first experience with a computer?
Well, I'm just reflecting on that. I think I'm going to try and give you two really quick ones because they feed into one another. I had just finished a Bachelor of Arts in English Literature.
You're both in English Literature. Wow.
Couldn't get a job and decided I'd go to graduate school, almost on a whim. My brother-in-law was in a graduate program, something about systems design. I didn't even know what it was, but they had money for research assistants. And I thought, hey, why not? We'll give it a try, right? What could hurt? So I got myself admitted. And lo and behold, there were computers all over the place. And these are big computers. They were mostly DEC 10s. I don't know what anybody listening would remember. But
I know what a DEC 10 is.
A vintage mini computer, but it would certainly fill this studio and more, right? A very large.
Univax, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I began my first programming class, coming from a background of English Literature. And about 3 weeks into the 16-week semester, I panicked. And I went to the instructor and I said, I can't do this. I don't know how this thing thinks. I don't know how to think with it. What's going on here?
What programs were you using?
Well, this was BASIC.
We were programming.
BASIC. I were programming. And the instructor said some things that didn't make any sense to me. And so I said, look, I just have to drop this. I don't know what I'm doing.
It was outside of the way you thought.
I'll get to that, right? So he said, sure, I'll sign your drop card, but you got to come back. This is a required class. So if you don't drop the program, I will see you again. Well, he was right. The next semester, I was back in his class. About 3 weeks in, got to the same spot, same assignment, and panicked, sitting there in the dead of night, looking at the, it's not spooky wires, it's these weirdly fluorescent green letters that sort of float off of the cathode ray tube, and it's like 2 a.m., right? Because you can't get computer time during the day, because that's for the important people.
Got it.
So I'm sitting there in the dead of night looking at this green phosphor floating in front of me, and I had an epiphany. It was, oh, wait a minute. This thing is incredibly stupid. I have to talk to it in little itty-bitty, teeny-weeny, the simplest steps that I can conceive of. And after that, I was fine. Okay?
And is that what happens to a lot of people, Richard Thien? You speak all over the world.
Well, I do, but what he's talking about is talking to the machine in a language it understands.
That's right.
I'm talking about talking to people in a language they understand about the machines and how their lives are being profoundly changed by them. And maybe we're talking about the same project, but we're at...
Personally versus globally.
Well, coming at it from two different ends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's people out there who are saying, you know what, it's just too complicated for me. A computer is just too hard. It doesn't seem to make sense. I don't get it. And they're frustrated.
Well, it's what you access. I mean, we're here at the university. People walk into the university library. There may be 2 million volumes. They don't have an anxiety attack because they'll never manage 2 million volumes.
That's true.
It's because there's a hierarchical structure of indexing which interfaces with them at a level they can comprehend. Used to be Dewey Decimal in my day. I'm sure it's changed.
It's Library of Congress.
Okay, yeah. But it's a pretty understandable thing, and you know you can go to sociology and shelf six, and there's the book you need. So it doesn't matter that you don't know what the other 900 million volumes are. You have a way to interface with complexity in a way that simplifies and manages complexity for you.
And, of course, anybody nowadays wouldn't even go to the stacks. They'd go
That's
to a
right.
computer, type in the author or the title or the subject, and let the computer tell them where to go in the library.
Because
or
now
even
we have that
let
interface.
The computer bring the book to them
right.
electronically.
And something like Google yeah. is that very interface. But we both remember, because we're silverbacks, you're not quite as silver as I am, we remember when it was, Gopher.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Which was
right.
just a hierarchical indexing structure, yeah, yeah. and they've just improved. I mean, but the key piece in this was the web browser. All a web browser is a knowledge engine, which manages complexity by providing an interface that enables you to engage with it intuitively and without thinking. And at that point, the computer is not baffling, difficult, or frustrating. It's just what's so, like turning the key in your car, and there's more computing power under the hood of your new car, whatever you're driving, then took us to the moon with Apollo 13. But you don't worry about it because it's all managed in a way that comes home to you in a key that you know how to turn.
Yeah, Richard, let me give you my second epiphany, okay?
Okay.
So it's years later. I've learned to program. I'm actually a proficient programmer in my living as a programmer.
This is in your 20s. You were before you were in
mid-20s. Yeah. Yeah, late 20s. So then the World Wide Web comes up. Now, I'm an assistant professor in what at the time was an administrative systems department. That's
okay.
what we called them. This faculty member comes into my office. He says, hey, you want to see something cool? I said, yeah. And he brings me back to his office. He says, watch this. And he does a click with his mouse, and up comes a picture of a bridge. I said, fine, you've got a picture of a bridge. Big deal. He says, no, you don't understand. This is in a web browser, and that picture just downloaded from a site in Singapore.
Oh, yes, I
and
remember
And I said,
that. Oh.
No way. No. You did not get that yes, picture from Singapore between the time I saw it and the time you clicked the mouse. And he said, give me a name. Give me a subject. I'll show it to you again. And I was just floored. I just sat there in his office for about 30 minutes just mm-hmm. trying things to make sure he wasn't lying to me.
You couldn't believe it.
I couldn't believe it.
What it gave you access to. Because you saw you literally.
Amazing.
That would have been like the early 90s, right? We were talking.
Yeah, maybe 95. When did Tim yeah. Berners-Lee do this? It was 95, 96,
maybe? Yeah, a little
maybe?
Earlier. A little earlier.
Yeah.
But you, it's like, what did Vannevar Bush call it when he wrote in 1945 the Codex Multi? I don't remember the term, but it was this global system. And we suddenly realized it was here.
That's right.
And we could go.
West Side listeners, has the world gone nuts because of computers? Or are most of you nuts over your computer? You can call us at 1-800-228-5615. That's 1-800-228-5615. Share your philosophy or give us a question. Author Richard Thieme is here, and UW-Eau Claire, MIS Department Chair Thomas Hilton. Give us a call at 1-800-228-5615. Welcome back to the West Side. In our conversation about cyberspace, some of you may be just a little bit tentative about going there. Some of you probably live there and can't imagine not being there. So we're getting a little perspective on that. I know, Richard Thieme, it's hard to keep up. It seems like you're on the computer all day, and I just get things the way I like them. The software works, does everything I want to do, and then somebody says, but we have to upgrade you. It's got to change. And it's like your comfort zone has changed. You like the way it was, and I don't want to change.
Right. That's what humans do. They don't want to change.
Well, everybody doesn't want to sit back, though, right? Some people just can't.
Well, people have different risk quotients and get excited by it. The task is, Fritz Perls, a great old psychologist, said the task is to change anxiety into excitement. And he defined it this way. He said anxiety plus oxygen equal excitement. Ooh. So the difference between someone recoiling in fear from a new experience or just shutting down, paralyzed, to crossing that line and suddenly ramping up and feeling the adrenaline pump and rushing forward into it because they're excited is very, very, very thin. It's how do we support people in going across that line? First, they have to see that it's a good thing to do, to risk encountering the new. And you're right. The new is coming faster and faster. Geometrical change today is going to be increased geometrical change tomorrow. It's not going to stop. But you can choose to occupy a slower niche if you want. Certain occupations or industries are not as affected.
And not be made fun of?
Well, what I was going to say
Professor
Hilton? Was, yeah, the slower, quote, track depends entirely on our perspective, because we can chunk information. We can chunk it. We can put information into globs any way our brain wants to. So for somebody like Richard, the field of information security is a chunk, or he could take that down, break it into chunks. For somebody else, they may have to have it in much smaller chunks, and then that would, of course, require a lot more processing for them to keep up with what he talks about. But it's very much a personal kind of thing. It's not one size fits all.
I remember the first time I was excited, now that you guys talked about what you were excited about. It was in the early 80s. I had the same Apple that you had, Richard. I think that early Apple, and the first program was VisiCalc.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking A1 plus B1 and put it in C1, or, you know, a simple addition. It's like, oh, my goodness.
It was so exciting.
It can happen.
We used to stand outside the computer store because a new program was a very, very big deal. You know, a new game would come out, or VisiCalc was one of the big ones.
Oh, it was.
What are your students asking you, Professor Hilton, or what are they learning? When they're in college, they're learning, obviously, to write macros and programs like you were talking, but what about this philosophical, the consciousness that Richard Thieme talks about?
Sure. Let me just contrast it with when maybe Richard and I were coming through. The way I think about it is that when he and I came up, we discovered the phenomenon of computing infrastructure from the inside out. We went and learned programming, or maybe Richard didn't, but I did.
From the inside out.
From the inside out. You learned the intricacies of it, and then from those intricacies, you constructed a sort of a macro vision of the whole thing, right? It was a very inductive building process. Well, now, the students that I teach, I see them coming at it from the outside in. They were raised. They don't know about the world without computers.
Does that scare you?
Well, no, actually, it's quite exciting. They bring a lot of interesting perspective.
Ahead of you probably in some areas.
In some areas, they always are, and there's a degree of humility that's required of the professor in that situation.
Right.
But it's a great place to be.
Humility.
It's a wonderful place to be.
Because the humility lets you have the kind of partnerships I was talking about.
That's right. Those relationships.
10 years ago, I went to DEF CON 4, 350.
Now tell us about DEF CON 4.
Well, DEF CON is a hacker convention, the best and the biggest. Now it's 5,000 people. I've spoken there for 10 years.
These are people. Now, describe hacker. We all think of it as a negative, kind of a nasty thing.
Well, you know, it comes out of the 60s. MIT came up with the word, and the best definition I know came out of Edward O. Wilson's Consilience, in which he described scientists as people characterized by passion, obsessiveness, and daring. And the best hackers, the ones at the head of the hump, not the humplings, the 80% that follow after, but the head, they are characterized by, they are obsessive, they are up all night, they are drinking Jolt and pouring their Aqua Joe coffee back through 15 times.
So that's why it's named Java, right?
It's right.
Now, will these same people, like you're saying, or be the people who buy a piece of, or a motor and took it apart piece by piece because they wanted to know what the inside of
it was? They wanted to know, and when they look at a computer or a software structure, a structure of information, they don't ask how was it built, what was it built to do, but what can I make it do? And that's the ingeniousness of hacking and crossing boundaries. And look, and this is the way the PlayStation originally, when they were developing it, the engineers who built the PlayStation brought in 10-year-olds and gave them all PlayStations and stood behind one-way glass and watched with astonishment as they discovered all these new things to do with it.
Wow.
Again, partnering with the kids, because it's the exploration of the cognitive space that computing discloses that results in so many unforeseen and unpredictable events. That's what's exciting.
You were talking about video games.
Yeah.
One of the biggest ones I know about anyway is Counter-Strike, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a video role-playing game. It's not a text role-playing game. The thing that I remember most prominently about that game is, I believe, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that was the first one where the end users became integral to the development of the next version. So that nowadays, if you download Counter-Strike, you not only get the game, you get the development tools.
That's right.
And you have full range to create your own worlds in that game.
Which is a perfect example of something that just fascinates and excites me, which is the symbiotic relationship.
Yep.
The Blade Runner reality that we all inhabit now.
What's the Blade Runner reality?
The Blade Runner is a wonderful movie about replicants.
Harrison Ford.
Yeah, were indistinguishable from humans. And the key question Harrison Ford asked was, of a replicant who didn't know it was a replicant, how can it not know what it is? But he was a replicant who didn't know he was a replicant too. Because your identity is constituted by memory. Well, memory in that cognitive space of the World Wide Web is exactly what's in transformation right now. Collective memory at a conceptual level we call history. And that's what's in the process of morphing.
Memory. Okay.
Yeah.
Memories, photographs.
Okay.
Let me just really quickly say that the genius of Richard Thieme's book, Islands in the Clickstream, or at least the thing that I love about it more than anything else, is this jumping via the bridge of analogy in and out of the computer world and the human world, where he sees the similarities between things that are happening in the computer world or even in computer infrastructure networks and things that are happening in the human mind or in human society.
Right.
We're going to stop for National Estate News, but briefly, the word clickstream, Richard Thieme, the title of your book, but the word clickstream is defined as...
It's the trail you leave in cyberspace going click, 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 click as
everything you type is saved forever. Is that right?
You're pretty known. You're pretty well known out
potentially
there.
Potentially saved forever.
Yeah.
Potentially meaning what?
Well, meaning that
if I type you an email, is it saved forever?
It's saved forever until it gets deleted. See, the forever part, nobody really knows.
No.
It's saved so many places, it might be forever, and if it's not, nobody would know.
That's right. It's on some server somewhere, maybe, probably.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, okay, there you go. Well, we are going to be back after National and State News. And if you have a question or a philosophical point of view you'd like to share with us, do that by calling 1-800-228-5615. We're having way too much fun. Richard Thieme is here, author of Islands in the Clickstream. He's speaking tomorrow to faculty members at the university. And UWMIS Chair Thomas Hilton is here. And it's loved. Wonderful to talk about the computer and cyberspace and internet. And if you're frustrated or don't like it, why? Listen along and maybe we can change your mind. The time is 5:30 right now. You're listening to The West Side. I'm Mary Jo Wagner. Welcome back to The West Side in our discussion about cyberspace and the interconnectedness between the internet and what we do and think. Author Richard Thieme wrote, if the mind is a chattering monkey, the internet is like a million monkeys pounding away at keyboards all over the world. The internet is proof that a million monkeys unleashed at the same time will not produce the works of Shakespeare. They produce homepages by the thousands, images of our egos run amok, and advertisements for our hopes and dreams. And noise, a lot of noise. A periodic retreat from the net is a necessity to sort of unplug and listen to the noise, and then, as the noise diminishes, to the silence. Coming back to the net, you roar with laughter at the antics of a million monkeys jabbering away day and night, and all too soon, there you are again, hands dancing on the keyboard.
Did I write that?
You wrote that.
God, I love me.
Richard Thieme is in Eau Claire today. He's with us. We'll be speaking tomorrow at the university. Joining him is Professor Thomas Hilton, who's chair of the Department of Management and Information Systems at UW-Eau Claire. If you'd like to join this conversation, it's 1-800-228-5615. I have to say the concept of monkeys jabbering all over the world is so lighthearted and perceptive, but there's a lot of people out there that might not like to hear what they're talking about is jabber, Richard Thieme.
Well, a mirror is often merciless, is it not? And we do jabber, and I do too, and I was not really joking. I don't remember what I write. I write this stuff over the years, and sometimes you like what you hear back, and sometimes it's just jabbering.
Well, and anybody who's ever been in a chat room or even watching somebody in a chat room where they might be running three or four or five or even six conversations simultaneously,
right.
It's easy to sort of see that as primate chatter.
It is.
Yeah.
Well, we should look at the downsides of all of this. I know, Richard Thieme, you are asked to speak. You mentioned DEF CON. You mentioned, or you speak to, well, engineering groups or computer groups all over.
It covers the waterfront. I spoke at the Pentagon a couple of months ago.
Why did they ask you to come?
To illuminate the dynamics of the culture in relationship to the way the technology was changing the culture itself.
And it was, what does that mean?
Well, what it means is that even military culture, as stratified as it is undergoing a major transformation. I mean, they have all kinds of language to talk about it, network-centric warfare, fourth-generation warfare, asymmetric warfare.
Are they asking warfare. You to pull it in and rethink some of this stuff? Or
in this case, it was illuminating for them with some practical suggestions. It was the people who defend the backbone of the country. They defend the backbone
of
the Internet.
The backbone meaning the digital backbone.
Right, yeah. Right.
And what are we concerned about?
Well, you know, really just about everything.
Everything.
But the major thing is what's important, because there is so much complexity. Complexity makes for a lack of security, because you cannot see all the variables and how everything interacts. And in order to defend, you have to have your priorities clear, and you have to know... above all, borders. I do a lot of talking about how borders are changing and
international borders. What geographic?
All borders. Identity is a function of borders. Security. So many intellectual property. So many things that we took for granted as intellectual constructions of prior technologies are literally going liquid on us as the borders around them change.
These are interpersonal borders, intergroup borders,
everything.
Inter-region borders, international
everything.
Borders.
You can talk about it at every
flux.
Level.
Yeah, they're all in flux.
Everything is in flux. And so that's good, right?
Well, it's what's so. I don't judge it as good or bad, but it's what's so, and how do we respond to it in the deepest human way?
It's tremendously exciting to me. I wouldn't say never.
Me too.
I don't know. Yeah, but yeah, good, bad, and indifferent is just really exciting. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing to be part of, not because it's safe, but because it is. It's
because
human.
It's exhilarating.
It's the human adventure.
It's a new frontier, but the frontier is as interior as it is exterior. Yeah. It's not just going over the mountain. It's going deeper and deeper into human identity and observing yourself in the process of changing. I mean, in the early days, computer security talked about perimeter defense. Nobody even pretends that you can defend the perimeter anymore. But part of the reason is because the perimeter cannot be defined. Most security intrusions that are dangerous come from inside. But then you raise the question, inside what?
Inside.
What is the boundary that defines the network? Who's plugged what into it? Who's accessed it remotely? And suddenly you realize you've got appliances and your new wireless. Someone will turn it into a wireless network. They'll just put up a base station in their place of work because they want to go to the bathroom and keep working, right?
And
suddenly the whole vast 10,000 machine network is exposed to hackers.
And then you've got the client,
right,
who you serve, who is the enemy that you must defend against.
Right.
And they're one and the same person.
That's right.
And what do you do with that?
Well, and an example on the global scale is we want free trade for the world. That's our empire, and that's our global imperative. And yet that means open ports. But open ports means any one of those boxes can carry in a radiological weapon.
Well, surely technological people and engineers know that. They don't need you to tell them that.
You'd be surprised.
Yeah, you'd be surprised.
Many
people, you know, smart people, but often granular in their focus.
Right. And they're inside their own box.
Right.
Really?
Yeah. And they don't often make the link to how it is changing them as human beings, even though they are immersed in the process. What I try to provide is reflection and illumination about what's going on. The way somebody from NSA really pleased me, because he's been listening to me for NSA's National Security Agency. He's been listening to me for 10 years. He said, I finally figured out what it is you do. He said, you articulate what we all know deep in our bones, but don't know how to say.
That's right. Yeah.
And that
that's why
me.
That's how he's like Emerson, right? I was saying he's like Ralph Waldo Emerson. Uh-huh. Emerson didn't make anything up. He didn't prove anything. He just kept saying things that everybody went, "Oh, right. Oh, yeah."
That's obvious.
Well, when you have a group of students, are most of them thinking past the murky edges outside the box, or do they come to you with just sheer programming desire and
But the people that I work with, the young folks that I work with who love MIS, are all about the technology. They have not yet discovered what you discover, I guess, as you mature, maybe, I don't know, that information systems is really way more about the information than it is about the systems. The systems are the wood paneling on the room. The information is the activity in the room, right? And these kids come to me, they want to make the gadget go. They want to have power. They really want to control their gadget or whatever people they might bump into through that gadget. But they don't really understand that their gadget is really part of the world. It's a megaphone through which they are talking. You know, the error message is in an application program. If you've ever tried to write a program and then code the text of an error message, you're always coming up against the question of whether who's talking here. Is it me, the programmer?
Right.
Excuse me, I think you made a mistake. Or is it you, the computer? You know, error number 609, you got a blah, 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 right?
Yeah, error 404, 414, whatever.
And these kids start bumping up against that about the time they graduate.
Oh.
And I think that was part of my major shift, too, when I realized that what the computer was, in essence, was a symbol-manipulating machine.
Yeah.
And that what we are, in essence, is symbol-manipulating organisms.
Yeah.
And that's why the fusion or the interface between them and how we program it, but then it programs us to think and construct reality in a very particular way. And it is a different way. Yeah. One of the things professors talk to me about that I love is they talk about plagiarism.
Uh-huh.
And I was talking to a group at MIAD in Milwaukee the other day, and I looked around the room. They're all over 50, you know, classic silverback white male crowd. And they learned plagiarism in a print text world where you had documentation like bibliographies, footnotes.
Yep.
They had rules. Yep. But those kids you were talking about who were socialized by this technology from the get-go know nothing but a cut-and-paste world in which information flows onto their desktop and they take a piece they want. And the borders of intellectual property are seamless. Yep. To try to redefine it in the old terms is like catching an avalanche.
Well, and you tell them that they're wrong and they give you this blank look like, wrong? What could I possibly have done wrong? You know, you wanted information. I got you the information. What do you want?
Is that changed? I mean, are those borders now not defined as far as plagiarism or downloading?
Okay, you know as well as I do about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and you may recall that I have severe reservations, notwithstanding my allegiance to the law and my maintaining that we need to obey the law.
I know, you said that here. You told the students, go out and do what they do, but do it in a public way. If you're going to download...
Civil disobedience.
Yes,
right.
you told us to...
But having said that, right, I mean, you can't be in this industry and not see that things are changing. So to say that, forgive me, all you record producers out there, the Recording Industry Association of America is so stuck on their old-fashioned business model that they can't even allow peer-to-peer file networks is ridiculous. They're, the old Luddite story comes to mind. You can't.
They're not going to be able to stop it.
No, they won't stop it.
Well, so then do I have to assume then if I do write anything and it gets on the internet, it's there for everybody? It is not ever again my words.
It's a pretty safe assumption.
Well, it's the new consciousness, though. You talk about the human race evolving into things that we can't even comprehend. We have not even got an inkling of it. So for you to say, what's the future? Well, I'll guess, Richard will guess, and we'll both look at each other and chuckle because we know it'll be something we never even thought.
Yeah, and I love that people introduce me as a futurist, and I laugh because I don't know what I'm having for dinner tonight. And I try to describe the present. But so many people live in the past that it sounds to them like the future.
Yeah. Well, what role does spirituality play? And I ask this because in your book, Islands in the Clickstream, you have a whole series of essays on digital spirituality.
Well, and a lot of people call these in their reviews of the book secular sermons, and they are a search for a moral center as our identities evolve. Spirituality is critical because it's intrinsic to the task of being human. To be a human being is to be a spiritual being, and that's not something you add on or can change. It's intrinsic to your very being, and therefore how you express it, how you nurture it, how you sustain it, communities of support that train you in it. I mean, I used to joke, but it's no joke, that 20 years of being a priest was simply being trained in being a more fully human being by the people who came to me. You don't go into it because you're good. You go into it because you need more training than the average person. And the average person will come and, if you're lucky, give it to you by sharing the depth of their humanity in a way that illuminates their resiliency and elasticity and spiritual power.
Mm-hmm.
This is in the domain of cyberspace just as obviously as it was in books or speech or grunting. or anything else. It's part of us.
And we'll ask Professor Hilton his connection to spirituality, too, when we come back. Give us a call. We have one segment left. If you're interested and want to join this conversation about cyberspace, 1-800-228-5615. That's 1-800-228-5615. And welcome back to the West Side in our last segment on the cyberspace issue. And Professor Hilton, digital spirituality. Now, you were telling me you both came from Utah. How does this fit? I mean, how can a MIS chair be even talking about spirituality?
Well, first of all, I was born and raised in San Francisco. You want spiritual diversity? Go to San Francisco.
That's it.
Okay. I was a missionary, a Christian missionary in Japan for 2 years as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The interesting thing, I don't know whether what Richard will think of this. They don't pay their ministers in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So I never had to give up my vocation because I never had one to begin with as far as a paying living, you know. So I've been a lay minister. I've been a bishop of a ward and had a rich spiritual life underpinning my professional life throughout my career, and I see them very tightly woven into one another. I'm reminded of the idea of a mosaic of where an Aborigine, let's say, puts stones in the sand to represent the constellations of gods, and then I have this vision of the internet.
Right.
Stones in the sand, nodes in cyberspace.
Right, or Indra's jewels.
That looks like our vision of God. What are we making here? It's a beautiful, beautiful thing.
Let me welcome Arlen from Eau Claire.
Well, hello there.
Hey, hi. Arlen.
Hello. Greetings to Tom, too.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good.
I just tuned in the show just a few minutes ago, and I've heard talk a little bit about the changing boundaries.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, one, how familiar either of you are with works by people like Neil Postman and Joshua Meyerowitz, who talk about, for example, Meyerowitz talks about no sense of place or the changing sense of place.
Right.
And also related to those, I'm a little bit familiar with some of the new technology, and you maybe have talked about this earlier in the show, and if I missed it, I apologize, about future changes in nanotechnology that may bring, is it possible, can we expect like human-to-computer interface and human-to-human interface, just thought processes being processed back and forth, and if so, what kind of changes that will have in our sense of
good question?
Yeah, very good question.
Of spatial dimension and things like that.
Last year when I published Islands in the Clickstream, another book was published called New Paradigms for Bible Study, based on a forum Bill Moyers did it in New York, and they asked me to do a essay for it. I wrote a 10,000 word piece called "Entering Sacred Digital Space," which looks at some of the likely interactions between the transformative power of technology and genetic engineering, which can be described in a way that includes nanotechnology as well, the alteration of identity through chemical and physical processes that we engineer. And then the third piece was the advent in the 21st century of a genuinely transplanetary culture, both us going there and them coming here. And the way these three things are going to interact and fundamentally alter human identity. Because culture clash always changes whoever was in the prior cultures in ways that neither of them could predict or foresee. And I think that's coming as we colonize the solar system and also contact species and civilizations elsewhere. That simultaneously with the alteration of our inner space through physical and chemical changes that we engineer in relationship to these technologies are going to create a humankind in this century, assuming we don't kill ourselves, which is always the task, that I think is
Professor Hilton?
Difficult to describe.
Yeah, I'm going to take your second question first. You talk about the human-to-machine interface using nanotechnology. Now, I've got to say I'm not an expert on this, so I'll just go ahead and tell you what I think, and then you can relate it to reality. But the from what I read and understand, there have already been silicon interfaces created. I'm thinking of a professor at UC Berkeley who has used, I believe it was a frog neuron to stimulate and be stimulated by a silicon chip, a transistor on a silicon chip. So that interface already exists. Now, what we're going to do with it is really something that I can't even begin to think about. I mean, there's lots of science fiction that goes down that road. There are some big issues, though, not the least of which being cellular death. It turns out that cells just don't last very long in that environment.
Thanks, Arlen. Let me go to Maria in Eau Claire.
Hi. My question is a little bit less technical and a little more philosophical. I think it's a very interesting subject, this interface between spirituality and technology. And it seems to me that in our culture, at least politically right now, those two ideas seem to be very much at odds with one another. They're almost seen as mutually exclusive. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on the current trend, say, as reflected by our current executive administration, on this apparent divide between the two, and if you think that has much impact, positive or negative, on the development of these technologies, and especially on the development of an idea of a functional merging of spirituality and technology.
All right. Thanks for the question.
That's a great question. This is Tom.
Professor Hilton.
Yeah, I'll go first, and Richard, I'm sure, will follow up with very insightful comments. I guess my thought is that what we're seeing now in that dichotomy the kind of the collision that you're talking about between spirituality and culture is something that has always existed, but has only because of the Internet been able to be expressed at the level it's now being expressed. We've got this huge communication tool that's allowing millions and millions of people to have a voice. Whereas before, and I don't know again whether Richard would agree with me, but before, the only way that millions and millions of people could express themselves that way would be an armed conflict. You had to get that many people together relating to one another and communicating, you had to put them in an army. Mm-hmm. It's the only way to do it. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not. So what I'm seeing is this open hostility, but my heavens, it's a huge step backward from the trenches of World War I, say. We aren't shooting each other. We may be hating each other, but we're not shooting each other. And I like that. I think that's a really good thing.
And the fact that we're moving through this transition is what enables us to see it. It's like the Terminator on the moon, where you can see the mountains where it's light and dark together. But the truth is that spirituality and technology have always been fused. And that was one of the insights that led me in the direction I have gone.
But always been fused.
Always. That's because sure. Technology is merely the means by which we add on to or biologically evolve or find ourselves self-creating the tools and techniques for complex civilizations and societies.
We make and tell our stories with technology. That's what
right.
we do.
That's right. But people don't see it. In the Episcopal Church, for example, there's a prayer book, and people would come in and read it silently to themselves. You do that today, and people take it totally for granted that that's, quote-unquote, a religious experience. But 300-400 years ago, that was a radical notion because people, A, couldn't read, B, couldn't read silently to themselves, and that created the Protestant Revolution deeply because the idea of an individual, you hear about, I have a personal relationship with God, quote-unquote, that was literally unthinkable before the printing press. No one could have thought of that category. So it's not just not biblical. It wasn't pre-Renaissance or pre-Reformation. And the technology is what enabled people to feel they had an individual pipeline straight to a deity because the technology mediated midwife the experience. And then it became so ubiquitous that fish to water, they no longer were able to see it and didn't see it as technology, but as just given and what's so.
And I get an MP3 sermon. I get to listen to a computer tell me about spirituality.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Richard Thieme, thanks for driving here from Milwaukee a day early. He's speaking tomorrow at the university.
It's great to spend time with you, Mary Jo. Thank you so much.
He was a teacher of English literature, spent 16 years as a priest, and now he's a thinker, speaker, commentator, and author. You can get some of his essays or read all of them if you'd like in his book, Islands in the Clickstream. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me.
Professor Thomas Hilton here to help me out here, doing a wonderful conversation. And
tremendous.
We've had him on before,
time.
And it was great when we had him on before. He chairs the Management Information Systems Department at UW-Eau Claire. It teaches computers, I guess we could simply say, huh? Thanks so much for doing this.
Tremendous time. Lots of fun. Thank you.
Thank you to Henry Lippold for producing The West Side, Dean Kallenbeck for on-air production tonight. Tomorrow night, the debate over how to manage the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. forest. Right now there's a lawsuit over how much timber should be sold from the forest. We'll have four people here, environmental groups, the Forest Service, timber producers, all be with us. We hope you'll join us. You're listening to The West Side. I'm Mary Jo Wagner. Thanks so much for joining us.